But they've struck out 44 times through 2 2/3 games in the series. I mean, one of them was a 14-inning game, but that's still an insanely high number.
Still got good stuff. He's got a mid-90s fastball, and he's got a wipeout slider.
Dear Mr. Dork, here's your ball. Can you please tell me which gas station you work at so I can come heckle you?
And welcome to episode 23 of Artificial Turf Wars, where we make our trade offers after the deadline. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined, as per usual, by the incredible Josh Howsam. Josh, how's it going tonight?
Well, you just called me incredible, so I can't really complain, can I?
I figured buttering you up once every 4 or 5 shows will keep you coming back for more.
And here I am just always putting you down. I feel bad now.
Pretty much. If I ever going to get someone to submit questions to try and stump you again, I have to paint you as the bad guy.
Touche.
We have, of course, the last week to discuss. We have the trades at the trade deadline have happened since our last podcast. The offense seems to have forgotten where they put the bats. Stroman has certainly maybe turned his season around. A few things in there. We have an interview with Stephen J. Nesbitt of the Pittsburgh, Post-Gazette.
Post-Gazette.
There it is. So many papers that merged too many times for me. About the Pittsburgh side of some of those trades, we have listener questions, and Joey Votto's going to get a gold star. But before we do all of that stuff, I think it would be right to start with a do-over of the topic du jour, because we're not going to avoid this topic, and I don't think we should cram it into that little tiny do-over segment. Aaron Sanchez. What are the Blue Jays going to do with Aaron Sanchez, Josh?
Nobody seems to know that, and that includes the Blue Jays.
Like, I there were some weird things that would come out of the Blue Jays when Anthopoulos was, in theory, in charge of the message. And I understand that. It was usually just for the sake of being obtuse. You could have argued in a lot of cases. And there was some funny stuff with J.P. Ricciardi. I liked his... you could say his famous line. Go ahead.
Oh, which one were that? Where he said that Adam Dunn doesn't like to play baseball?
No, about the truth. Important.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, the best one ever. It's not a lie if we know the truth.
It's like, wait, no, that's the very def. Okay, thank you, JP. So that'll live on for a long time. But now we have. What is the last message we got? Was from John Gibbons before tonight's game. We're recording before the final. Is this the final game in Houston?
Yes.
Yeah, before game 3 in Houston. We're recording actually during the game. But before the game, John Gibbons came out and was saying that maybe Aaron Sanchez in the bullpen isn't a done deal.
And I lied. It's a 4-game set.
and I'm not even going to edit that out because you lied, not me.
Yeah, but... Yeah, he said that there's no decision been made, even though 2 days prior it said the decision was being made to do this, and it was just a matter of when. And then Spire goes on Primetime Sports and says, yeah, there's no way he's pitching the whole season in the rotation. And, God, it's just such a confusing mess. So, just say nothing until there's a decision.
Yeah. Like, just because someone asks you a question doesn't mean you have to keep giving a different answer every time they ask. Russ Martin did nothing to help the team stay on message when he went on Tim and Sid.
Yeah, he sure has said, I don't want this to happen. He should start the whole time.
What? Like, you had to know from Russell's perspective, if you're going on Tim and Sid, that question is going to get asked. And you have to know, I assume, as the Blue Jays, that if you're letting Russell Martin go on the Fan 590 in a long format interview, you got to prep him with, would you mind either steering clear of or staying on some sort of message?
But how can he stay on message if they don't have one? They don't know.
This is a starting pitcher who is, and I don't think we're exaggerating to say, having a Cy Young caliber season.
Yeah, I think you probably argue he's the front runner right now.
So I understand the difficulty in saying, hey, we're going to do X, because either way you lose with some portion of the fan base. But I thought this was all supposed to be based on something with Aaron Sanchez's ability or performance, not about how people would feel per se if he was moved around.
We seem to have heard a lot of things about what it should be and what it's going to be and what it might be and what it shouldn't be. And the answer is it's nothing at the moment. Aaron Sanchez is a starter for now, and that's the only thing we know.
Yeah, and he is actually scheduled to start Saturday.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. After, is it Liriano takes his first start?
That's correct.
So that is probably... there's a masterclass in how not to handle a public announcement in this non-decision about Aaron Sanchez's status. Do you have a personal opinion about it? Dare I
about
ask?
What they should do?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we got some questions about this. We should probably just acknowledge
them.
Okay,
well, we can save it for the question period.
No, I'm going to talk about it now, but just, right. I just want to say that Luke at Spork V and Dave Goss, he told us how his name is pronounced again.
Because he's a boss, yes?
They asked what we would do. And, you know, based on our conversation last time with Dr. Mike Sun and, you know, the availability of the starters in the rotation, I'd be interested to see if they could use some sort of modified six-man rotation where you have Stroman, Dickey, and Hap rolling every time out, every 5 days. And then Estrada for his back, Liriano and Sanchez, you mix in when openings come up. So it's not every 6 days for them. Sometimes it could be 8 days. Sometimes it could be nine. But it gives them time off.
Recuperation time. I can see that. My take
I haven't worked out how that would actually work and how many stars it would be because, you know, I don't really care that much. But I would like to see them do that and then maybe shut him down or something. If there's more risk in him going into the bullpen... But again, I don't really know. I'm not a biomechanist or anything like that.
And my take would be, if you actually have a smoking gun that says Aaron Sanchez is at risk of injury, if you really have one, shut him down right now. Just say, we're shutting you down. That's it. And we'll look at the state of the rotation come, say, the middle of September. And if we need to, you know, put you in the minors and ramp you back up again for some reason, then we will. If you don't have a smoking gun, let him take his turn every fifth day.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little more nuanced than that, but I just don't know, right?
I'm not a...
Nobody knows.
Yeah. That's my personal opinion. That doesn't mean that's what they should do. And it certainly, like you, doesn't mean they're actually going to listen to our math or our opinion. Thank God.
But it's a do-over. They're supposed to come on here and fix it.
Well, they have to fix the PR nightmare, not what they're doing with Aaron Sanchez.
Right.
just decide... announce, and we will never talk about it again because you've given us far, far too much to talk about. We shouldn't be talking about this for four. This is the fourth podcast in a row we've had something to say about Aaron Sanchez at the bullpen.
I know. I was kind of hoping we wouldn't have to, but then this whole debacle happened.
It was like the topic of the day. All right. So we'll move on to the week that was. So they were 3-2, I have it, since the last podcast. That's taken 2 out of 3 from the Orioles and split the first two games in Houston. So rewind to the Orioles series at home. They looked really good overall.
Yeah. I guess you could say for the first 25 innings of that series, 24 and a half.
Yeah. And I think... I think you could see that the Orioles really do have a pitching problem that they tried to address with, was it Wade Miley?
Yes.
There's some names that just do not inspire me, and Wade Miley is one of them. But they, you know, that really revealed the warts of the Orioles rotation and or long relief corps, that it is not without its problems. Even though the Orioles are still in first place. However, the third game revealed... I don't know what it revealed. It revealed that Jesse Chavez was probably not going to be a Blue Jay very much longer.
Oh, man. We're going to get to the trades in a second because obviously we need to talk about them. But that's an era that is happily come and gone.
It didn't look bad on the face of it, did it? The Jesse Chavez era?
When it started?
Yeah.
No, it seemed like a good pickup. I think I was openly in favor of it on this podcast.
Mm-hmm. And then the actual season happened, and there were a lot of hard-hit baseballs that we weren't expecting to come off the bat of Jesse Chavez, which, yeah, that's how we do.
And they all went over the fence.
That game also, I believe, marked the final appearance of Franklin Morales, did it not?
Yeah.
Who experienced a 4-mile-an-hour drop-off from when he was throwing his fastball in the one instance he came in the game in April?
Yeah, 3.5 or so.
That's a lot of miles an hour in a very short period of time.
Yeah, so maybe the injury wasn't so phantom after all.
Yeah, it turns out he wasn't faking it. Whoops, sorry. Sorry if we ever intimated that.
Our bad, guys.
He may have actually been severely damaged. Okay, so, and then they managed to score a total of 3 runs in the first 2 games in Houston. So the offense has taken its own all-star break or something. Like, and they are striking out like mad. What happened?
They're up 3-0 in the 3rd game in the 6th. But they've struck out 44 times through 2 2/3 games in the series. I mean, one of them was a 14-inning game, but that's still an insanely high number.
Mm. This is what they were doing in April, right? This was where we thought, my God, is this offense ever going to get on track? All they do is whiff. And that was with Justin Smoke playing every day. Well, not every day, but that was Justin Smoke in a regular rotation. So,
well, I mean, he's been replaced by Melvin Upton, who has the worst contact rate in baseball among qualified players on pitches in the strike zone.
So you're saying
that wasn't going to fix that problem.
This is the brand now. K's and bombs.
Yeah. Well, speaking of K's and bombs, so we talked about how they're having trouble scoring runs. They're really having trouble scoring runs when they don't hit homers. The last time, again, this is as of the 6th inning of Game 3, that the Blue Jays scored a run without a home run was in the 2nd inning of the Sunday game against the Orioles.
That seems like a very long... So basically one whole podcast ago, they scored a run. Oh, that's interesting. That's...
Lots of solo homers.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. So... We have an anemic offense, but they actually somehow managed to squeeze out 2 home runs, which was enough to win last night. And I was kind of incredulous that the bullpen held a 1-run lead for 2 innings without using Roberto Osuna.
Yeah. Yeah, Danny Barnes making his major debut.
Now, should that really be shocking me that much? Like, is that a sad state of the bullpen reflection?
Yeah, so it shouldn't be shocking you that much, but it's not surprising that it doesn't.
There's a Twitter user, The Road Guy,
he
tracks how many times the Jays have held a 1, 2, or 3 run lead and for how many innings successfully. And the numbers are just abysmal. That was like the 7th time in the 4 months of the season that they've held a one run lead for more than 2 innings, or for more than an inning without giving it up.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
It is. That's ridiculous.
Is that real?
Yeah. Yeah, if you follow The Road Guy, he has a running tally.
I do, but I was out, so I didn't see that.
Yeah, 7th time they've held a 1-run lead for 2 innings or more, or just 2 innings. I was like, oh my God. Okay, the trades. Do you want to break all those down? Because I'm probably lost one somewhere in there.
Nice segue.
Yeah, no trades. Trade the bullpen. We did trade the bullpen.
That's true, we did. So as you sort of alluded to, Chavez is out. These two moves are sort of, I would take them in tandem. Actually, all three, but these two especially. Chavez was flipped to the Angels for Mike Bolsinger at almost the exact same time that Feldman was acquired from the Astros for one of those low minor league arms that the Jays, you know, the rookie ball guys.
Right.
Also named Chavez, by the way. But,
not complicated at all.
No, not at all confusing. So Feldman steps into the role that Chavez was supposed to fill, which is the swing man who pitches well.
There's no role for a guy who pitches badly, is there? It's like, oh, you'll be our swing man who gives up 4 or 5 runs this year. Do you mind?
What do you mean there was no role for that? The Jays have had a few foot guys carved out in that role this season.
That's not very nice.
And Bolsinger goes to AAA to become starting pitching depth because they have traded Hutchison.
Right, and Hutchison was the real big show.
Yeah, this was the you know, if the Jays were going to make something called a blockbuster deal, this was it. They traded Hutchison to Pittsburgh for Francisco Liriano and two prospects, Reese McGuire and Ramirez. I forget his first name. I'm sorry about that. We have someone who can speak to them.
Harold. Later.
Harold Ramirez. Thank you.
Because I thought that's just not a name that fits with Ramirez at all in my book. I actually think those two players sound very much like the players you get in the low minors on MLB The Show.
Anyway, back to real baseball. But, yeah, so basically, we have our actual Pittsburgh of help coming up in our interview, so we can go in a little more depth there. But it's very interesting to see the Jays flexing financial muscle for the first time in, I don't know, years, ever? I can't remember the last time this happened since the early 90s. You know, they picked up salary in the Upton trade. Not a ton, but some. Mm-hmm. They picked up salary in the Feldman trade. They ate all of Chavez's salary, and they ate all of Liriano's salary, which meant they didn't have to give up anything valuable, depending on how you view Drew Hutchison.
Well, but they got something of value in technically as well. That's
right,
the first time
on the whole contract, they got those two prospects.
That's a
and
move.
Both
that's
of them
the part of the
be
move
big leaguers.
That I don't remember seeing that move in ages and ages and ages, where you both bolstered the farm and the major league roster, giving up because you took on cash or salary. That dynamic has not been a Blue Jay dynamic in ages and ages and ages. You're right. So
yeah, I mean, essentially, you're right. They managed to improve their big league club and their farm system at the deadline, which is really hard to do.
Yeah. The only teams you would see doing that, obviously, would be like Boston or New York if they were, you know, finagling a deal from someone else. But yeah, weird. Does that cover everybody?
Oh, we should talk about Liriano a little bit more because of what he's actually going to be for this team. You know, he is, for the last few years, he was excellent. You know, he's always been a bit wild, but he's so hard to hit, and he's one of the best pitchers in the National League. This year, he's been terrible. His control is just gone. He's leaving too many pitches over the middle and too many pitches nowhere near the plate. But as you may mention in the interview, as though we may have recorded it before we do this part.
You're breaking the magic radio-ness. The spell is broken.
Anyhow, yeah. But I mentioned this in the last podcast with Benoit. The Jays have been getting these guys, Grilly, Benoit, now Liriano, whose stuff is still there, but who are walking extra people with the hope that they can sort of fix them.
And the Blue Jays did have after having a horrible April and May in 2015, they had the lowest walk rate in baseball over the last 4 months of the season. So
among pitchers.
Yeah. So, the good walk rate. So I think that the reason they might be doing this is not that they have like some secret, but more or less they've found that they've had success doing it in the past. I think it's actually a strategy for them is to say we focus on getting the ball into the, you know, command and control in the zone, and it's worked, so let's keep doing it until it doesn't work. It's my guess.
Yeah, but I think part of it is just like they look at these guys, Grilly, Benoit, and Liriano again. Oh, with extreme outlier walk rates, like way off their career levels. Right? Liriano's at a career high, and when you consider some of the years he had in Minnesota, that's really, really high. And it's just basically it's like this can't continue because it's not who this pitcher has been.
And it's a reasonable gamble to take. It's not like hoping a guy will get miles an hour back on his fastball, like you allude to with Storen.
And it also sets up the rotation for next year, which most people tend not to really talk about because, you know, it was going to be Hutchison probably taking Dickey's spot. But now there's upside, well, I think much more upside than there would have been with Hutch. Now they have legitimately four or five guys who could be number one or two starters, probably five.
That's slowed down.
2017.
So you probably want to talk about one of those other starters before we go to the interview, because I have it here on our notes that you wanted to go back to Mr. Stroman.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Mocha Stroman has had a rough season. There's no denying it. You know, his ERA is 4.74. But he's made some tweaks. After that game where he got just crushed in Oakland, you know, we talked about this on the podcast, where he went back to just throwing a zillion sinkers and nothing else. He has fixed his pitching. He's fixed his pitch usage, throwing more cutters, curveballs, sliders, everything, and he started getting strikeouts.
And that is the magic ingredient for Marcus Stroman, because even with all the stuff he's been tweaking and playing around with, he hasn't seen the strikeouts go. And if you look at your top leaderboard of guys who throw a lot of innings and have a lot of success, you gotta now have your 8 or 9 strikeouts per 9. And Stroman has been at 5 or 6 this season, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in his last 3 starts, he has 6 strikeouts, 7 strikeouts, and 13.
That's a bit of an outlier, but we'll hope on that.
Yeah, but it's interesting when he did that, like 23% cutters. The games where he has thrown his most cutters are the games when he's gotten the most strikeouts. So there might be some correlation there, but basically he's pitching the way he has to pitch. You know, he gave up 4 runs in 6 2/3 against the Padres, but 3 of those runs scored late on an Alex Dickerson home run. And, well, we mentioned last podcast how he was just doing that.
Yeah, that was he was a ridiculous phenomenon as opposed to a batter for at least those 3 games.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it's encouraging.
Yeah. So we are going to, like I said, go to the interview with Stephen Nesbitt now, because we did want to get into more depth about who is coming the other way in the Pittsburgh Pirates. Nelson, I knew I was going to call him Nelson Liriano eventually. Francisco Liriano and Drew Hutchison trade. I am not an old man. We'll be right back after this. And we are happy to be joined by a new guest here on the podcast. It is Stephen Nesbitt from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we are actually bringing you on because you have some experience with Pittsburgh, obviously, being one of their beat writers. We wanted to get your angle on the deadline deal that went down. So I guess we would start... Why would Pittsburgh do a deal where they give the Jays 3 players for Drew Hutchison?
Yeah, we're still trying to figure that out a little bit. I think it comes down to a pretty simple answer, which is the Pirates, in order to be a stronger team next year and in 2018, they needed to unload some of Francisco Liriano's salary. Again, they're unloading about $17 million. And for a club like this, not like you guys who are spoiled with some pretty large payroll, the Pirates, that means a lot. $13 million a year was not that much to pay Liriano for a 3-year free agent contract. But for the Pirates, it's a big deal. And so when he's not performing, then they had to make a move pretty quickly. They worked the phones a lot trying to get any team to take that deal off their hands, and ultimately came down to Toronto was willing, but it was going to be costly for them to do that. Now, if you ask the general manager, which we did, why did you make this move? He says the primary goal of this move was to get Drew Hutchison, which, frankly, I think is just his talking point. I don't think he believes it. I think they'll take it. It's always good to have a controllable starter, and they again, Hutchison could slot into the rotation next year. He could be helpful. They think they can figure some things out for him. And I don't think they picked up a guy who they don't believe can help. I think they do, but it was costly. And so no, the primary goal here, although they won't say it, was not just to get Drew Hutchison. It was to unload salary and let them be more flexible next year. Let them add some pieces. Let them make next year's team better when they don't believe that Liriano right now, as it currently stands, is going to really help them or certainly be worth $13 million next year. So I think that's what it comes down to. But it was a pretty straight salary dump, but they think they got something in return that's relatively valuable.
Now, given the fact that it is essentially a pretty transparent salary dump, and this team is only 2.5 games out of a wild card spot at the moment, what has the reaction been like? I mean, in the clubhouse, have you been able to talk to any players or from the fans you've interacted with about this?
Well, yeah, certainly I've heard from a lot of fans. I'm not with the team right now. They are in Atlanta. I was with them in Milwaukee right before the deadline. They traded their closer, Mark Melancon, which, again, a move where you can certainly understand why they did it. It's a guy with an expiring contract, and seeing what Aroldis Chapman got, they figured they might as well take advantage of it. And I think, honestly, that one's going to play out for them really well in the long run. A closer at this point in the season is going to win you, what, maybe a game and a half. And he's again, best closer in the league the last 4 years by the numbers. But you can lose him and still give yourself a fighting chance this year. And I think that's basically what they've done here. So again, I was not in Atlanta, but I think the basic, the simplest way I can explain what they did this week was they didn't strengthen their team. There's very little way to describe a scenario in which they made their team any stronger this week, because they got rid of their closer. And again, still have a pretty good bullpen. They'll be all right. They have a closer in waiting anyway, Tony Watson. And then they get rid of Liriano, and he essentially is replaced by Ivan Nova, who they brought in as a two-month rental. And Nova probably will be better than Liriano has been, as long as they stay sort of on level, sort of stay where they have been all season. He'll probably be a slight upgrade, but he's not a game changer. He's not a huge difference maker. He's not going to be the reason they make the playoffs, most likely, if they do. So what they did was they opened up some salary for 2017, and they can add this offseason. But they did that while not completely putting themselves out of the race this year. They left themselves with a chance to compete this year. If a lot of things turn around in the last 2 months, sure, they're 2.5 games out right now. If Andy McCutchen stops hitting 241 and starts hitting 315, if Josh Harrison turns things around, if Francisco Cervelli gets healthy and is hitting closer to 300 like he did last year, if the starting pitchers, they can find five and things turn around, then great. They absolutely can make up this two and a half game difference. They can make up that by the end of, you know, this week or next week. So they absolutely have a shot still, but it was not a good enough shot where they needed to, at the trade deadline, bet on this team and really do a whole lot to make it better, because they've seen the last 3 years, they go to the wild card game every single year. You see that there's it's not luck, but you can run into an ace pitcher like they have in Bumgarner and Arrieta the last 2 years, and all of a sudden, who cares that you won 98 games last year? You were a wild card team, you lost in the wild card game. And so this year they're set up not as well, and they realize that they can still give themselves a fighting chance despite not adding at the deadline. So they didn't completely, they didn't completely cripple themselves this year, nor did they build up a stronger team than they had a week ago.
But are people upset that at the same time they also gave away pieces for the future that could be used in other moves that could have strengthened the team?
Yeah, that's the troubling part of all this. And again, with a guy as shrewd as Neil Huntington, I think there is a way I can look at each one of these moves and say, I get it. I understand why he did that. But this is the one where it's troubling, because he's had a talking point for several years now where the Pirates refuse to trade their top prospects for major league talent. And they said they did small moves, like they sent Dilson Herrera for Marlon Byrd, who was a 1 month rental, and he helped them in a year where they got through the wild card game and finally made the true playoffs. But other than that, they've been unwilling. And he says, because as a small market team, our best avenue to getting top prospects is going through the draft and developing these guys, and they have done that. They've had one of the very best farm systems the last few years. And it's paying off this year, and you're seeing a number of – we've had – I think over here we've had 10 guys debut this year, and another guy made his first career start. And so there's certainly a youth movement happening here, and that's going to pay off for them in the long run. But these two guys in particular are ones where you could make an argument that their paths to the majors were blocked. They just signed – Francisco Cervelli to a 3-year contract extension. They have their backup signed for a little bit, another year, Chris Stewart. They have Elias Diaz at AAA, and Reese McGuire is at AA, struggling a little bit to hit, and that's going to be a question for a while. I imagine this guy is absolutely going to make the majors at some point. He might end up only being a backup, and that might be okay as well. But he's a guy they felt that they had enough depth ahead of to where they could give him up. And Harold Ramirez is an even easier one to explain why they give him away, is he is a guy who they truly like. There's no question about that. In spring training, Clint Hurdle called this guy a bone collector because he just gets hits. And he hit, I think, somewhere over north of 300 during spring training. And even though he's a pretty young guy at 21 years old, when he was with them, he showed really nicely. And he's hit basically over 300 everywhere he's gone in the minors the last couple levels. But the problem is they have guys under contract through, I believe it's McCutchen is 2018, Starling Marte, I think, is 2021, and Gregory Polanco's 2023. So this is a guy who, yeah, he'll get base hits, but he doesn't have power, and he doesn't have a whole lot of speed, and they simply feel like they aren't going to need him anytime soon in the majors. And so he could be a chip that you trade away. Now, again, people certainly, to answer your question finally, yeah, people certainly don't like the fact that they gave away two top 10 prospects when they finally decide to, sure, we'll give away some prospects. It's not to get major league talent. It's to get a guy they're going to stow in AAA for a little while. And basically they used two top 10 prospects to entice the Blue Jays to swallow this contract that they didn't want to pay for themselves. Some teams in bigger markets would have simply eaten that salary themselves and not worried about it, and certainly wouldn't give away two prospects for someone else to eat that salary. But that's just the nature of being a small market team and the decisions the Pirates have to make. So people are not happy, but I think there is a way to look at it where it makes some sense, even though it is a little bit disappointing.
Well, all right. Well, that's certainly an interesting perspective on it. It's not something we've really had to deal with here. But just should quick note, New Hampshire is playing today. They're up 4-0. RBI single from Harold Ramirez and 3-run double for Reese McGuire. Bad trade.
We win. Yay.
That's how this decided, right?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's over.
I found it interesting that the Pirates would have to move that much to get rid of Liriano's contract, because a lot of times when we see a trade with the Jays, we see someone moved who is in low A or is, you know, an international signing who's 19 years old or 20 years old, and nobody's ever really necessarily heard of the guy, and he gets described as a lottery ticket. I'm from what you've described, you wouldn't describe either of these guys as a lottery ticket, would you?
I don't think so. I think they could turn into good pieces. I don't think they really are quite lottery ticket material. Although I guess I don't necessarily completely understand. But give me a little more tight definition of what a lottery ticket is to you.
A lottery ticket is someone who hasn't proven anything yet, but has you know, a high ceiling. It sounds like both these guys have proven something, because we moved them to double A, or the Jays moved them to double A right away.
Right. I think, yes, they both had proven that they are quality prospects. I think neither had proven that they're elite prospects. And the Pirates, the one thing you can say for what they did at the deadline is they kept their elite prospects. They had a couple guys who the Rays were trying to get a hold of in exchange for starting pitching. Josh Bell, the first baseman, and Austin Meadows is essentially the heir apparent to Andrew McCutchen there in the outfield. And they did hold on to those guys. They held on to their own starting pitching. And I think this was a tier of prospect that they felt would have value in the trade market, but also would not be completely mortgaging their future, because I think they do have enough time. There are questions with these guys, and you'll see it. They're again, Ramirez is a corner outfielder who doesn't have power, and that's, you know, not great. But again, he's young, and maybe that'll develop. And McGuire is a guy who's an elite defensive catcher. I think that's going to play really well at every level. And again, just 21 years old himself. But is hitting 259, I think, when he left Altoona. And again, no power. He's got four homers in 323, looks like, minor league games. So we'll see if that stuff develops. But at this point, these are not guys who were going to rocket to the majors anytime soon. And so they felt like, they're not necessarily those lottery ticket guys that could haunt them. But I think if either of the two is one of those guys, it's probably Reese McGuire, because you want to hold on to quality major league potential catching.
Well, as the Jays have found out, having absolutely no one other than Josh Tolley to back up Russell Martin at the moment, which, yeah, we'll get into that some other day. So I guess we'll take it to Liriano, who is the major league piece here and has been very good from 2012 to 2015. Could you go into what's happened to him in 2016?
Yeah, it's been a pretty perplexing year for them. If he was pitching the way he did the last couple of years, they would have no problem holding on to his contract. That's again, $13 million per year is not huge, even in this market. But what's happened this year is pretty much the things that that plagued him earlier in his career, and the reason he sort of got derailed when he was, you know, leaving Minnesota, he went to Chicago, and then finally came to Pittsburgh and sort of rediscovered himself, was that he is a guy who, if his command gets away from him, he has a hard time regaining it. And he's always a guy who's going to walk a few guys. He's got the good thing for the Jays here is that he's still got good stuff. He's got a mid-90s fastball, and he's got a wipeout slider that continues to be one of the best pitchers that I think a starting pitcher in the major, one of the best secondary pitchers that starting pitchers in the majors have. His problem is he has thrived for years on getting guys to chase that slider out of the zone, getting to chase any pitch out of the zone. And this year they simply haven't. I don't know if it's because his pitches are so obviously out of the zone now that guys aren't swinging. I think it's less of that and more of a scouting report has gotten around the league to say, don't chase on this guy. Don't attack him early. Make him come to you. And if he gets, you'll see so often he gets behind 2-0, and that means he has to groove a fastball in there. They know it's coming. And major league hitters can hurt you really, really quickly if they know what's coming. And so that's been his issue, is if he gets two strikes, he can put somebody away. But he's been falling behind in the count so much. There's a stat that Clint Hurdle likes to keep track of during games, and he will tell us the number at the end of most starts is how many outs did this guy get on three pitches or fewer, right? Efficient outs there. And this last outing in Milwaukee, which came right on the heels of Liriano throwing, I think it was six innings and striking out 13 last week against Milwaukee, is he went five innings, four walks, four hits. Four walks, four runs. And he only had three outs on three or fewer pitches. So he's a guy who has absolutely struggled with an economy of pitches. And that's something where in the majors, if you spike your pitch count, you're going to go five innings, and you're putting the rest of it on the bullpen. And so his stuff is still there. His command is not. And that's I guess the Pirates decided at some point they weren't going to be able to fix him, at least soon enough to be sure that his contract, which is a big one for them, is going to be worth it.
That's interesting, because the Blue Jays have lately picked up a bunch of guys who have problems with walks and don't seem intimidated by that at all, or have at least had short-term problems with walks. So we'll see what they can do.
And we'll hope that he turns it around, and for your sake, we'll hope that Hutchison pitches well, because we always liked him here, even if he was occasionally somewhat maddening to watch.
Yeah, I think they do like what he... what he offers. They think it'll help him to get a change of scenery and all. And I think they truly did get a piece they think they can help that can help down the road. And if he turns into a four starter, a three starter, then this deal will probably have been worth it. Although there's a whole lot of risk involved in giving up those prospects. But Hutchison will be an interesting one to watch, because they have a lot of options. Not right now necessarily, because a lot of these guys are rookies, but next year they have a lot of options for who they can plug into the rotation.
So as a final note, I don't know if there's anyone that you could talk to. I don't get a lot of chance to talk to Pittsburgh folks, but if there's someone who is responsible for the Jose Bautista trade that you know, I'd just like to say thank you, because I haven't personally been able to do that.
Yeah, I think they've cleaned house on most of those guys, but maybe I'll reach out, I'll try to find some guys. I know they that's one that the Pirates have done well to stock the Blue Jays system. I think the only one lately that hasn't done a whole lot for the Jays is Tony Sanchez, who was a former first rounder who I believe got released from AAA Buffalo recently. He did pan out, but otherwise the Pirates have done a good job of shipping guys up to Canada and having them help out for the Jays pretty well.
Except Brad Lincoln, too.
Well, that's true. Although he came back here last year and was in spring training, too.
Return home.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us, Mr. Nesbitt. You do have a Twitter. What is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter is just my name. It's Stephen J. Nesbitt, StephenJNesbitt.
Stephen with a PH. Perfect. All right. Well, folks, if you're looking for some Pirates news, info, and all that stuff, follow Stephen on Twitter. And again, thank you, Stephen, for joining us and giving us the other side of the trade story.
All right, man. Guys, I appreciate it. Good to meet you.
Take care. And we are back after a view from the other side. I do enjoy talking to somebody different.
It's always nice to get the perspective of people who've seen something from a little different angle than we have. And especially in this case, it's like, hey, what's actually been happening with this new guy we just got?
Yeah, and we really don't see, even with interleague play, you don't see National League players very much. So I think that's cool. We have, of course, listener questions. Because Yay. We enjoy those sort of interactions. The first question is the CNE Seagull, who has asked before, at CNE Seagull. Can you name all of the Blue Jays, if any, who will be inducted into the level of excellence before Halliday? That's an interesting
one. I just
one.
Named them all. He's going to be next, for sure.
Well, yeah, you would think. Because there are no epically good players is
I'm actually surprised it hasn't happened yet.
We have Delgado's already up there.
Yeah, I was there when he was inducted.
Steve, Hanke, Carter, Alomar, Tom Cheek, because he's not a player, but he's there.
And Cito.
Cito Gaston, also not a player, also there. Yeah.
And George Bell and Beeston, that's the list.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone who really made their mark between, like, this. I don't think Pat Henkin ever gets up on the level of excellence.
No, I don't think so either. Barfield was a great player here, but Halliday was the best pitcher in baseball, and he was a Blue Jay for 10 years.
And he made it a special effort to stay a Blue Jay twice.
Yeah. I think it's him. And that's why I said I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, especially when he came back and did that sign the one-day contract, retire as a Blue Jay thing. I thought for sure part of that was a negotiation of going up on the level of excellence.
And yet, no. Well, maybe with 40,000 fans, maybe they don't need to come up with an excuse to get people out to the ballpark.
They're doing all this 40th anniversary crap this year. They definitely still do that stuff.
Yeah, true. I don't know. Maybe they're just sort of waiting for it to settle. Maybe they have their own, like, time limit on things like that. They unlike the Hall of Fame, don't really explain the rules to. Question two. If you had two and could only get rid of the one Blue Jays TV crew announcing team, who would it be, why, and are you sure? So which guy would have to go?
It's just one guy. It's Tabler. It could be anybody else. But it says which team.
Yeah.
It's definitely Buck and Tabby.
Yeah, again, Buck has his place. So I think if you pair him up with Dan Shulman, I could listen to Buck for, 81 games a year.
But if it's a team, then it's them for sure, right? Because, as the team, it's Buck as an announcer and Tabby as an analyst.
To me, I lean towards getting rid of Barry Davis.
But he's not on the announcing team.
Blue Jays TV crew.
Oh,
it's right there. And Barry Davis just annoys me. Even in short bursts, personally, I find his interview style non-existent, and you can tell talk about how good you felt and how excited you were when you came onto the field for the first time today in the seventh inning. You just talked about it, Barry. You covered it. So I would get rid of Barry. I think probably the players would appreciate that as well, but that's just a guess on my part.
Yeah.
One more question? You got something?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a kind of a fun one. CNE Siegel asked again. He seemed to be in the nostalgia mode. First, we had the Halliday question, and then this one was inspired by Kevin Pillar making a very nice diving catch in today's game. Who is the greatest Blue Jays defender in history? Tony Fernandez, Devon White, Robbie Alomar, Jesse Barfield, and Kevin Pillar. He didn't actually put Pillar in there.
No. I don't think Kevin Pillar's played long enough to get into that conversation. I am actually really torn between Tony Fernandez and Devon White, to be honest.
Ooh, no Robbie.
No, I love what Robbie did, but I tend to believe the numbers on that, in that he was excellent at going to his left. Unreal, in fact, I think, to basically cover most of John Olerud's work. But to go to his right apparently was a real weak spot for him, and I would have to view a whole lot more film. Devon White made it look so easy. Like I can remember on one hand how many times it was like, oh, that was a difficult catch. It was like he was already there. I was like, this is incredible. There's no way you're always just magically under the ball. So to watch that, that was, for me, the best way to watch defense, is when it was always effortless. And Tony Fernandez, well, Tony Fernandez was Tony Fernandez. That little sidearm flip was just so fun to watch.
I think sidearm would be generous.
The flip. Do you have a preference?
I think I'm with you. I think Devon White is the best center fielder I've ever seen. Him or Andrew Jones. But I mean, the fact that it's him or Andrew Jones says about how good I think he was.
Yeah, you certainly, you know what company he's keeping when you throw that. I kind of wish I actually got to see Gary Maddux play, because he's the one about whom that old saying was created. The two-thirds of the world is covered by water. The other third is covered by Gary Maddux.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's been applied to like a dozen center fielders since then, right? So I'm kind of curious to see how Gary manned center field.
Yeah, well, sadly we did not get to see that, but we did get to see Devo, so we're lucky enough.
We will count him as his equal, barring any other evidence. Okay. I have a gold star to hand out, so this is a bit of a convoluted one. Joey Votto, I believe it was last night, relative to when we're... Yeah, it was last night. Went to catch a foul pop-up in Cincinnati. He leaned into the stands... And this GIF was all over the internet, so if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can find it. Leaned into the stands, and the ball, as he was leaning over the first row, he got tangled up a little bit with a fan, and the ball kicked off of his hand or his glove, didn't make the catch. Votto looks down. The guy standing in front of him is wearing a Cincinnati Reds jersey. He grabs the logo on the jersey and looks at it as if to say, I can't believe you're cheering for the Reds and you got in my way. And then he walks back to his position. So you would think I was going to give him a gold star for putting a fan in his place, which I probably would have anyway. But it gets better. Joey Votto felt bad. And if there is anything that cements his status as a Canadian baseball player, he felt bad about showing the guy up. So he signed a baseball which said, I'm very sorry, I was out of character earlier. He gave the baseball to the man in the front row, learned his name, and apologized to him. And this is Joey on what his why he did that. Here you go.
I don't feel a responsibility to be some sort of example or anything like that. But I do feel like to treat my fellow man with respect, and I felt like I was in the wrong completely there. So
I felt like I was in the wrong completely. Like, oh my God. Yeah, so only Joey Votto could somehow make this about treating your fellow man with respect and come out. I don't know. It just, it blew my mind that he took that perspective on it. So to you, Joey, a gold star.
You know what that just reminded me of? I think it was Bautista in Cleveland when he threw the signed ball to the, or the non-signed ball to the fan. It's like, who was heckling him.
That
it's
was,
like, sorry, it's like,
was it Vernon Wells, I think.
Oh, it was Vernon Wells. You're yep. Right. Yeah. And it said your favorite outfielder didn't even sign it.
That started dear idiot, dear moron, let me know where you work.
And I'll come down and heckle you at the, yeah. While you're pumping gas or something.
It was hilarious. And I was like, I can't
yeah,
believe it.
Yeah, it's like, dear Mr. Dork, here's your ball. Can you please tell me which gas station you work at so I can come heckle you? Find your favorite outfielder.
Not exactly the same sentiment. Votto's position, of course, on the whole thing was that the fan was not, in fact, leaning into the field to play or trying to bother him. That Votto was leaning into the stands, and the fan had every right to be there. Which I don't know if every player would think that way, but he saw it that way. So again, I was kind of astonished at the coolness level. I think we're pretty close to wrapping it up this week, so I would give you a chance, which I didn't really give you a chance last week because you had to stick in your final thought over the closing music.
Yeah.
To give me a final thought.
Well, we should just, my final thought is just Tulo, who we didn't even touch on this, broke his thumb.
No biggie.
Yeah. Yeah. No big deal. He has a chip fracture in his thumb. He's going to play tomorrow.
Of course he is. Well, as soon as they said it's about pain tolerance and nothing more, that was from George Poulos. What did we learn last year about Tulo and pain tolerance?
He has a ton of it.
With a shattered back.
Yeah, he has the most fragile bones in baseball.
But he cares not.
No. Although, in fairness, 93 miles an hour off the thumb is going to break a lot of people's bones.
So I'm hoping that with the return of Tulo, the lineup maybe calms down and chokes up a little bit and starts thinking about passing the baton again. It seems like the ego of this lineup is broken when some members are out of place, like the next guy can't be trusted anymore or something. I don't know why that is, but that's when they really start swinging, is when they're down a man or two.
I've noticed that. That's interesting.
All right. So that would mean that you have been Joshua Housam, and I have been Greg Wisniewski, and our guest was Stephen J. Nesbitt. You can find me on Twitter at coolhead2010, and you on Twitter at Joshua Housam, and Stephen at Stephen J. Nesbitt with a PH on the Twitter if you would like. And this has been episode number 23 of Artificial Turf Wars, and we will see you next week.